This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about how the U.S. Congress is increasing its aggression against progressive communities in Latin America.
We've already seen a number of coups and attempted coups in the last decade. This conference wants more of the same. More coups, more overthrows of progressive governments.
Stay with us.
Michael, there's been zillions of words and articles about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and of course, in this country, he's looked at as a pariah, despite the fact that, of course, that every newspaper in the country is covering what he has done, and he's obviously made a major contribution to our understanding of how our government runs. But give us a second on your political take on what you think of WikiLeaks.
You know why I like him? I like him for the same reason I liked it when the Russian revolutionaries opened the books and all the Tsar's secret diplomacy, and they showed how First World War was an imperialist war, and it showed the secret deals between France and England and the Russian Tsar on how to divide up the Ottoman Empire once they won the first great war, of the 20th century, the first great imperial slaughter. They wanted to divide up the Ottoman Empire. And in 1916, they had a treaty called the Sykes-Picot Treaty, where they whacked up all this rich Ottoman stuff between France and England.
But even then, Michael, let's just say, it wasn't just rich Ottoman stuff, it was oil. Because what was happening is the ships were turning from coal, where they needed fueling stations all over, to oil burning. And they recognized that. And so when the First World War, during it actually, they were going to divide up the oil in the Middle East.
Oil. You remember when they stupidly called the war against Iraq Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL, and they realized they made a dumb mistake and they changed it? It's still about oil.
So let's put it into perspective. So you're saying the First World War is really about imperialist overreach. The second example we have is, of course, the Pentagon Papers.
Uh-huh. Same thing.
Same thing. Again, about showing the lies about the war, supposedly to, you know, whatever, help the Vietnamese people, whatever, BS, stop communism. But, of course, it was, in fact, about the U.S. in the Far East and its role in the Far East and what Ellsberg was able to do. Now, let's compare it here. What have we seen in these documents, the wiki, that makes you also see that really what he has exposed here is imperial overreach?
Well, he's shown the nature of these governments that the United States installed and props up in both oil-rich Iraq, carbon-rich Afghanistan. And that's what's horrifying people like Hillary Clinton. The secrets are coming out, the nature of these governments, how they talk to each other. WikiLeaks provided a service. They opened the books on America's secret dealings the same way the Russian revolutionaries opened the books up in 1917. That's what's driving these people crazy. They're threatening not just to prosecute them for espionage. That's the soft line. The right-wing commentators on Fox News and people like Sarah Palin are calling for his death. They're inciting violence.
Let's go back for a second. I was thinking to myself when you and I were talking earlier why I like what he's done so much. And I think you put your finger on it, that here the U.S. goes into the Middle East and into Central Asia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran now it's looking at.
Yemen.
And it's saying, we're doing this because we want to stop terrorism. And, of course, it's another question about how this makes terrorism grow. But we want to stop terrorism. And, you know, Bush said for a while, we want to bring democracy to Iraq. And what these cables do is demonstrate, really, that this is a central core of the U.S. mission right now, is to control the oil resources and other resources of the Middle East. And they show it that the U.S. is doing it sometimes overtly. Of course, it lies about Iraq and Afghanistan, but sometimes it's doing it so the American people don't even know that it's doing it. And that's Yemen, where it said to the Yemenis, claim that you're doing that bombing, even though they all have our names on them. Or it says the claims by a government publicly that Iran is helping the Taliban, when in fact the cables show that that wasn't the case, that they didn't have any evidence on that. So what you're seeing from these cables is the focus on where a U.S. hegemonic empire is concentrated and how they're lying to the American people about what the U.S. is doing there. So the American people can't even object to the wars. They can't even protest because half of them they don't know about.
Well, that's exactly right. And what what I really like about WikiLeaks is that it enables the American people to have access to information on an equal basis as the secret bureaucrats. That's the basis of democracy. Having a free press is the basis of democracy. You know, characters like Joe Lieberman trying to cut off WikiLeaks at the knees shows just how they despise democracy. What Chomsky said to us when we talked to him last week, they despise democracy, and that's why they despise Julian Assange.
And I think we do want to say something about the charges of rape and sexual assault going on in Sweden. Charges like that, of course, have to be taken very, very seriously and have to be investigated. I would hope that everybody's in agreement about that. But in this case, what you also see is a series of questions that make you wonder why it's being treated in a certain way. And, of course, question number one is that he was in Sweden, right, Michael?
He was there for 6 weeks trying to give his side of the story, and they wouldn't talk to him.
And so then he leaves Sweden. They know he leaves Sweden. He goes to the United Kingdom. They then begin an issuance of a warrant for him, a warrant not to pick him up on the actual charge because he hasn't actually been indicted yet,
right,
but just to answer questions. And he was willing to answer those questions by a video monitor, by going into the Swedish embassy. But no, they want to bring him back to Sweden, and he's going to be facing extradition now to Sweden.
You know why I think they want to bring him back to Sweden? It's easier to get him out of Sweden than to get him out of England. That England has much stronger tradition of guaranteeing liberty and extradition than Sweden has. And they want to snatch him and bring him back here and put him in handcuffs and parade him in front of a federal judge and in front of all the major networks. That's what they want
to do. So we have the questions. Why was he allowed to leave Sweden? Why are they not allowing him to be questioned in the UK? Thirdly, why was he denied bail? That to me is really interesting. This guy's denied bail. Yes, he's wanted for serious questioning about serious charges. But here's the situation. He's been in England for a number of weeks, apparently. His lawyer's been in touch with the police and Interpol, and everybody's saying, as soon as you get a valid warrant, we'll surrender him. He's not running away. He didn't run away. He surrendered voluntarily, went into court, and then he gets denied bail on the grounds that, you know, there's some money around for him, supposedly, that he travels too much. But this is a guy who surrendered. So there was no, it's inexcusable, inexcusable that he didn't get bail. And that makes you think that they don't want to let him out of their prison because ultimately they want to get him to Sweden. And then I think your point is right. The difference between throwing a 2-ton weight, which you can't even lift against the wall, that's the United States. They can't lift the United States and squash it like a bug. But Sweden, a little country of 7 million people, let me tell you, it's like when that bartender puts his hand down on the flea. Goodbye, flea. Goodbye, Sweden. Sweden is going to be much easier, I think. I don't know this, but certainly in terms of world politics, much easier to get Julian Assange out of than the UK. So if you have to ask yourself, not that the charges, whatever they turn out to be on investigation, we don't know, but very odd circumstances surrounding getting Assange back to Sweden make you question whether or not it's not the hand of the United States behind it.
It obviously is. And I think that they want him in jail to gag him, that he's a symbol of democracy around the planet. He's got a lot of support, and they don't want him talking. You read his latest article, probably his last article that'll be published on the internet, and it really is a stirring, beautiful article about what he and the other handful of people at WikiLeaks are trying to do in providing this information so that people can make their own decisions on the legitimacy of American foreign policy. They don't want him as a spokesperson for the democratic forces around the world that rely on what WikiLeaks has been able to do. And that being said, they can salt him away, which they've succeeded in doing so far. But out of 250,000 cables, they've only released 305. These things are in the pipeline. They're going to come out no matter what they do to Assange. He's not stupid.
Yeah, I think it's up from there now. It's in the 700s. But
is it really?
Yeah, yeah. It's up from there on the Wiki site, on the WikiLeaks site. But of course, other newspapers, I think The Guardian has all the cables. They're just releasing them slowly. But it's true that there's lots of people with these cables now. There's lots of people who can put this stuff
out there.
The
major newspapers in Spain, Germany, right, England, and America have these things. They're just as guilty as Julian Assange.
Well, that I think is I think that's the really strong point. You know, Senator Lieberman, our wonderful, what do you want to call him, a chameleon senator, depending on on what kind of...
Chameleons are cute.
Right. What kind of background do you... Anyway, he's a right-wing so-called Democrat. But
how about reptilian senator?
But he's the one who said, well, we should be looking at the New York Times, he said. But we have to tread carefully because of the First Amendment. Yeah. Of course, he would never say that about WikiLeaks. And the point is, that this country is going to have to figure out, and it's going to be hypocritical when they do it and selective when they do it, how they can go after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and not go after the New York Times, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, and every other press and person who's ever published this stuff. Now, you know, knowing their way with words and their control of a lot of the press, they're going to try and do it. But let me just say, it's outrageous. I mean, the New York Times, if Assange and WikiLeaks are in the dock, I would want to see the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and The Guardian El País right next to them. And those newspapers, if to the extent they take a position that somehow there has to be some prosecution of Assange or WikiLeaks, they are being not just holier than thou, but being outrageous.
They should, if they had any sense of journalistic decency and solidarity and stood up for their noble profession, they should come out and support Assange. In a sense, Julian Assange is a journalist, not a whistleblower. But Bradley Manning was the guy that leaked this, and they've got him in solitary confinement. He doesn't see the light
of day. Let's be very careful about leak this. We actually don't know what Bradley Manning did.
That's true.
We really don't know. First of all, there was a claim that he did the helicopter tape. The one of U.S. Yeah. helicopters murdering two Reuters journalists and others in Afghanistan. Even that has not been verified, but certainly anything subsequent to that is even more speculative. I actually have no idea what Bradley Manning's role was. I mean, the government has him in some brig in Quantico,
yeah.
you know, claiming that he's a guilty guy, but I don't know.
Let's talk about what people might be thinking about doing in support of Julian Assange and in support of free access to information and ultimately in support of democracy here in the United States.
Well, I think for starters, don't believe the lies you hear. Don't believe that people have been injured by what he has put out. Even the American government says.
Not a single person.
Not a single person that they can trace any harm to any of the
That's
tapes.
Right.
Secondly, focus on the big picture. What these documents are doing is really in part destroying part of the American imperialist adventure. And that's critical, absolutely critical. It's showing the utter duplicity of our government. It's showing how even though, for example, in the cases that we at the center work on, our Spanish prosecutions against Bush and others, or against the lawyers and others, it's showing that the U.S., claiming it wasn't going to do anything hands-off, even under Obama, has gone to those judges, has gone to the ministers in Spain, and trying to get those judges dropped. So you're talking about a government that is not just hypocritical in the sense of saying one thing about a diplomat and another thing in the cable, but hypocritical and lying about the most fundamental issues of our democracy. And so keep your eyes on that. Third, understand that what WikiLeaks has done is really earth-shattering for us and really is going to make a profound difference in how we look at our democracy going forward. And therefore, you have to support WikiLeaks, you have to support Julian Assange, and you have to fight the incredible repression going on here. Because look what's happened here. First, they're labeling Julian Assange as a terrorist. There's people calling for his killing or assassination out there. Then they're claiming all this damage to people. Then all of these so-called First Amendment-y type internet providers, et cetera, Amazon, PayPal, credit cards through Visa have cut WikiLeaks off.
Yeah, but so you know what? MasterCharge and Visa, if you want to join the Ku Klux Klan, you can pay your dues through MasterCharge and Visa, but you can't support WikiLeaks.
So look what they've done. They've labeled WikiLeaks. They've labeled Assange. They've claimed damage. They're cutting Wiki's access off to all the internet servers. So-called net neutrality is out the window in this case, despite what Michael's saying about everything else you can join. And then they're differentiating Wiki and the New York Times. So this is an assault that, I mean, I guess the way to think about this is McCarthyism, is a new McCarthyism. They're isolating, labeling, calling terrorists. But in this case, they're not going to succeed as well because there's a huge groundswell of support around the world and in the United States for WikiLeaks.
Absolutely. You know, let me just conclude with a final thought from Julian Assange, who posted this on the internet. In its landmark ruling in the Pentagon Papers case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, quote, only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government. The swirling storm around WikiLeaks today reinforces the need to defend the right of all media to reveal the truth.
As you're saying, Michael, like Shakespeare, the truth will out. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. But I know you also have a nomination for Julian Assange, or at least you're thinking about nominating him. And I think it's for an interesting prize.
Well, I hope you'll support me on this, Michael. I think we should nominate Julian Assange for the Nobel Peace Prize. After all, they gave it to Obama last year as he was escalating the war in Afghanistan. Let's give it to somebody who really deserves it.
Oh, Michael, I just remember all those excuses liberals gave about giving it to Obama and the idea that maybe it'll make him, maybe it'll make him be against war. Of course, remember his speech was he disagreed with the last Nobel Prize they gave to an American for peace, which was Martin Luther King, who, of course, was a pacifist and, of course, against U.S. imperial wars as well. And, of course, he disagreed with that. And then he takes the Nobel Prize, and what do we get? We get a secret war in Yemen, a secret war in Pakistan, our targeted killings, which, of course, leads us to our next update. Now we have the Alawaki case.
Let's talk about that. The decision came down out of the D.C. district. We lost. What's the significance of that loss?
As people recall, we've covered the Alawaki case a couple of times on Law and Disorder. He's the American-born citizen, Muslim cleric, who is living in Yemen, and the U.S. has revealed, maybe because they wanted a test case or for whatever reasons, to make people feel unstable, they've revealed, not exactly acknowledged, but practically acknowledged, that he was on a hit list to be assassinated as a terrorist, Al-Qaeda, whatever they call him. We, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU together, went into federal court saying, "There, you can't just, particularly outside a war zone, in a country like Yemen, target an American citizen for death without having some kind of judicial oversight. The president's power should not include the power to target any person in the world, including an American citizen, for death. If it was in a war, in the middle of a shooting war, yeah, you shoot some, if a guy's on the other side is an American citizen, yeah, the guy gets shot. But think about that awesome power." And so the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU went to court, a long argument, two-hour argument in Washington before Judge Bates. And we just received a couple of days ago an 85-page decision saying that he was tossing the case from court. Now, in that decision, he said he was tossing it, but at the same time, he took the case extremely seriously. Let me just give the technical reasons he tossed it. We were representing the father on behalf of his son and on behalf of himself, and not the son, because we don't have access to the son. And normally in federal court, you can represent someone who's representing the interests of their child in a court if you can't have access to the child or to someone who can get access. But in this case, the judge says, no, the father does not, and the technical word is standing. The father can't stand in for the son, so you're gone, guys. That decision is, you know, certainly a legalistic one. But the next part of the decision, he also dismissed it on what we call political question. Yeah. And I spent my life litigating this issue around everything from wars to torture, where you go into court and what the court says is the kind of question you're asking. Can the president murder an American citizen overseas, assassinate him? That question is committed to what we call the political branches. That's why it's called a political question. By political branches, they mean the Congress and the president. And we as the court can't look at that issue. Now, the judge himself was troubled by this. And what the judge said, there are circumstances in which the executive's unilateral decision to kill a U.S. citizen overseas is, quote, constitutionally committed to the political branches and judicially unreviewable. I mean, just got to hear that again, that the executive's unilateral decision, Obama's own decision, to kill a U.S. citizen overseas is somehow committed to the president himself, and a court can't look at it. That is, I mean, outrageous.
That's what Nixon said.
I mean, you can't hear anything worse. I mean, can you hear anything worse than that?
That it's legal because I say it's legal.
I mean, and it's legal. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, the court can't even second-guess a war if Congress has approved it and the war powers in Congress. I think they can. It's not second-guessing. They can look at it constitutionally. But this case, some American citizen out there, the president says, well, I think I'm going to knock you off today. You know, it reminds me, the best it reminds me of, it's close to this. Remember when King Solomon fell in love with Bathsheba? Bathsheba was unfortunately for King Solomon, married to somebody else. So what does he do with Bathsheba's husband? He sends Bathsheba's husband to the front lines of whatever war King Solomon is fighting. And, of course, Bathsheba's husband gets killed. And then he, of course, marries Bathsheba. So I think it's Bathsheba, I'm pretty sure. That's how he does. And that's the story. So today it's Eliwaki. Tomorrow is it Bathsheba's husband. And no court, according to this judge, can tell the president no.
What's really chilling is that the death sentence goes out on Eliwaki. His father, fearing that his son is going to get murdered, tries to get legal representation to stop it. And the court says, you can't represent your son on this issue. Well, what's the son supposed to do? Walk into the lawyer's office so that a drone can take him out?
That's, I think it's a really good point. All of us who have loved ones, children, spouses, think about if there was a wanted poster, dead or alive, all over the world about your spouse, children, or husband. The idea that you couldn't go into court and say, you can't kill my child. I can represent my child on this. He can't surrender. He'll be shot on sight. How can you do that? So both parts of this decision, that the father can't represent his son on a murder, and that somehow the president on his own can order the murder of any U.S. citizen anywhere in the world. I mean, that's breathtaking.
It's absolutely frightening to contemplate how this thing could evolve over the next period of time in this country. And you start thinking about a place, like Central America, during the dirty wars, Argentina, when the executive just took out all his enemies. There was nothing done about it. Is this the beginning of that? Michael, in the so-called peace process in the United States, it's just announced that it's laying off of Israel, and Israel is now continuing to build its settlements. What's your take on that?
Well, Michael, as I don't have to tell you, it's been laying off of Israel since 1948 and before. So it's nothing new. But Israel claimed it was doing a moratorium on some of the settlements in the West Bank. It never claimed any kind of moratorium on any kind of construction in East Jerusalem. And even the push by the United States to say, renew your moratorium, Israel, was never going to cover East Jerusalem, was never going to cover current construction going on in the West Bank, and was never going to cover planned construction that was going on. So it was a non-moratorium in only part of the territory that had already grabbed. And even the United States, with all its power that this world knows, and with some little dinky country with a few million people in it, like we talked about Sweden, that the U.S. could throw up against the wall, they can't get them to stop the settlements, not even in East Jerusalem, but in the West Bank. And of course, they should stop them in East Jerusalem. It's all stolen land, and they couldn't do it. So the U.S. just looks like this helpless giant in which it's letting this small country just do whatever it wants under its foot. But of course, that's not the case. What's your thought about that, Michael? It's not the case that it's one little country that opposing what the U.S. is thinking.
No, I think what Noam Chomsky said was absolutely true. The United States calls the shots here, not Israel, and that the United States is not under the thumb of the Israeli lobby. It's not a case where these lobby is saying to the American executive in Congress, back off and let them build. These people need housing, you know, back. It's not that at all. They could stop it in a second. They don't want to.
You know, I was just thinking, we finished Thanksgiving a few days ago, and I just think about the main thing you hear about Thanksgiving is gobble, 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 gobble. And as we sit here in this studio, and as the United States, you know, meanders around here, and as Israel for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years continues its practices of, what is it doing? Gobble, 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 all of Palestine. And that's what we're seeing unfold in front of us.
Well, it's made it impossible to have any kind of two-state solution. There's nothing viable left to form another state. It's all Israel. So Israel, in a sense, has made a one-state solution. It just has reduced a huge number of people to second, third-class citizens.
One big apartheid state in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month, members of the extreme Latin American right wing held a meeting in Washington with high-level representatives of the U.S. Congress. The event is evidence of an escalation in U.S. aggression towards the region, writes Eva Gallinger in her article, U.S. Congress to Increase Aggression Against Venezuela and All But Countries. The U.S. Congress members at the meeting include House Foreign Affairs Committee members Elliot Engel, from New York, a Democrat, and the current chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and Connie Mack, Florida Republican and incoming chairman of the same committee. Elena Ross Latinin and many more met with the extreme Latin American right-wingers responsible for coup d'etats, terrorism, and destabilizations. Eva Gallinger joins us today from Caracas, Venezuela. Eva, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We understand from your coverage that a number of extreme right-wingers in Latin America had a meeting 2 weeks ago with a number of representatives of the U.S. Congress. Talk to us about that meeting.
Well, the meeting took place in the U.S. Capitol, in the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center, as it's called. It was on November 17th, and it was titled Danger in the Andes, Threats to Democracy, Human Rights, and Inter-American Security. It's not clear if the event was actually proposed by U.S. Congress members or simply hosted by the U.S. Congress. There were a series of other local Washington think tanks, right-wing conservative think tanks that were involved in setting it up as well, such as Hudson Institute and America's Forum, all of which have expressed a very critical agenda against the rise of left-wing governments in Latin America over the past decade. The meeting counted on the participation of several figures, personalities from Latin America, from the extreme right, and in fact, several of whom are either currently fugitives from justice in countries such as Venezuela, in the case of Guillermo Zuluaga, who a major business owner and president of a media outlet here, an opposition television station, Televisión.
You're speaking to us from Caracas, and this is a right-winger from Venezuela.
Yes, I mean, that's why I'm sort of emphasizing his role, because he's someone who's played a consistent role here in Venezuela in trying to destabilize the Chavez government. For example, he was involved in the coup d'etat against President Chavez in April 2002, and since then has used his media outlet to make baseless accusations against the Chavez administration for all kinds of things, trying to link Chavez to drug trafficking, terrorism, and trying to demonstrate that this is a dictatorship, which is ridiculous because he's doing so through a media outlet, his media outlet that operates on the public airwaves. But in any case,
well, this is the Fox News affiliate in Venezuela.
It's the Fox News affiliate, that's correct, in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And he's also a major business owner of other enterprises here in the country. And so he was charged last year by the Attorney General's office with financial irregularities and some corruption charges. And instead of facing the justice system, fled to the United States, where he's now applied for political asylum and is obviously being received by the highest levels of U.S. government, including, you know, being asked to participate as one of the main speakers at that event in the U.S. Congress. So we have figures like that. There were others such as Lucio Gutierrez from Ecuador, who is a former president who was actually ousted in a popular uprising, or some you could call it a coup, in 2005 in Ecuador, but charged with corruption as well. And then he was just involved on September 30th in an attempt to overthrow the government of Rafael Correa in Ecuador. And so he was another one of these figures that was, you know, lauded by U.S. Congress members in November as, you know, being some kind of individual who's promoting democracy in the region, when in fact he's just involved in a coup to overthrow a democratically elected government.
Eva, what about Bolivia? What sort of people from Bolivia were at this meeting with the U.S. Congress people?
There were several individuals from Bolivia, particularly some that were involved in 2008 in attempts to overthrow the Evo Morales administration and also propose a separatist regime in the country to actually divide Bolivia into two republics. And this effort was led by extremist, separatist, right-wing, again, in the what's called the Half Moon of Bolivia, the southern, more tropical, western or eastern regions of the country, that where the majority of the economic power is located. And in fact, one of those who was involved or who participated in the meeting in the U.S. Congress in November was involved directly in an attempt to assassinate the president of Bolivia, which sounds completely fantastical, fictitious, but in fact was very real. And those involved in the plot that were the direct sort of executors or authors of the attempt to assassinate Evo Morales were in fact killed in a firefight with the Bolivian police forces. And that took place as well in 2008. So Luis Nunez, who is the head of one of these civic committees, as they called them, in the region of Santa Cruz, which was the bastion sort of the separatist movement a couple years ago, was also invited by the U.S. Congress to participate in this event and of course, expressed reasons why U.S. government should increase its hostility and aggression towards governments such as those in Bolivia and Ecuador and Venezuela. So overall, I mean, the event was perceived here in Latin America by those countries that were implicated as very threatening. And there were U.S. Congress members such as Ileana Rosfatinen, who's Republican from Florida, who's slated to be the next head of the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Relations Committee. She's the ranking member right now. And Connie Mack, another Florida Republican, who is also slated to be head of the subcommittee of Foreign Relations on Western Hemisphere Affairs, so directly, you know, in charge of crafting and designing policies towards Latin America.
It's really serious what you're saying. And, of course, you've documented, and we all, I guess many of our listeners realize, how many coups there's even been in the so-called quiet coup period, you know, or attempted coups, you know, Venezuela, Bolivia, Honduras.
Honduras.
Successful, you know.
Ecuador.
Ecuador. So we're already talking about a region which the U.S. and others have had their hands all involved in because of the progressive change that have happened. Name some bad figures heading some congressional committees with some very bad relationships. And, you know, we both, I mean, all of us have seen from 73 when there was Allende and other progressive governments. We've seen what happened in Central America in the 80s. I mean, do you think there's a chance, despite the U.S. heavy focus on the Central Asia and the Middle East, which is what I think has given these countries a little bit of time to find their own way, freedom from the United States, do you think we may see a change from that?
I think there is a change taking place, and it's exactly correct that a lot of people are unaware, particularly in the United States, of what's been happening in Latin America over the past decade in terms of, you know, a shift towards more progressive governments and policies and regional integration, but at the same time an increased assault on Latin American stability and democracy coming from, you know, forces that either held power in prior years or want to take power. In the region, most of them appear to be conservative, far-right-wing organizations, groups, parties, and individuals that are linked to the same sectors in the United States. And in Latin America, yeah, we've seen five, either successful coups or coup attempts over the past 10 years that most people are unaware of. You know, Venezuela in 2002, Haiti in 2004, we had Bolivia in 2008, Honduras in 2009, and then Ecuador this year in 2010. And two of those were successful, Haiti and Honduras. And they've all been right-wing coups backed by the United States.
No, that's a remarkable list when you put it together. So all of us who've said, you know, well, now we're all busy in the Middle East, we're letting Latin American flourish. Yes, it's true to a certain extent, but there's always been at least one hand on it. You laid out three questions, I guess they did, at this meeting on Latin America in Washington. And the last question was, is current U.S. policy toward the region equipped to respond to the erosion of democracy, of course, their words, and the pernicious influence of such hostile actors as Iran, domestic terrorist groups, and narcotics traffickers? How do they answer that question? What happened at the meeting about that?
Well, on the U.S. side, representatives not just from Congress, such as Rosfatinen and Connie Mack and others, including Democrats, it wasn't just Republicans, were at the meeting, but there were also well-known figures from U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America that have played a key role in influencing that policy for several decades, such as Otto Reich, a notorious Cuban-American who's worked with the Bush administration, the Reagan administration, operated.
Well, you know the joke about Otto Reich. He's got two brothers. He's the third Reich.
Okay, well, something like that. This is an individual who's been involved in dirty wars against progressive governments in Latin America now for decades. And Roger Noriega, who's another one, who's also been ambassador and an assistant secretary of state in Western Hemisphere Affairs during the Bush administration. They're all from that team of Negroponte and Elliot Abrams and Oliver North that were involved in the Iran-Contra affair. And they continue to influence foreign policy towards Latin America because they may not be in the government today, but they're in the private sector as consultants and advisors working through these think tanks that do influence U.S. foreign policy. The decision that they came to, the conclusion they came to at the meeting, was that the U.S. isn't doing enough. These are individuals and groups that have been pushing for a more aggressive U.S. policy towards the region, which is even more worrisome for those of us down here because there have been already all these coup attempts to overthrow democratically elected governments.
And these people justify what they're doing in the name of democracy and human rights when they're pursuing just the opposite. It's really ironic. Let me ask you this, Eva Gallinger. On Cuba, there were a lot of people in the United States that were hopeful when Obama got elected that America's stance towards Cuba would somehow change. Given this conference and what you're saying, what do you think about that possibility now?
No, I don't think that that's a possibility. I think, you know, that Obama may have expressed that during his campaign, but once he got into office, realized that it was a near impossibility. Unfortunately, these are the sectors, those that are now working against Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador from the U.S., that still control U.S. foreign policy towards Cuba as well. And that's sort of a vital piece of U.S. foreign policy that doesn't seem to shift very much from administration to administration. So we haven't seen any change in terms of U.S. policy towards Cuba, and I don't see any indication of that happening, particularly because now the policy towards Cuba is equated directly with Venezuela, and the policy towards Venezuela is linked to Ecuador and Bolivia because they all form part of this regional bloc called ALBA, which is the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. So, for example, in 2006, the Bush administration created a special intelligence mission that's actually above CIA. It's directly below the Director of National Intelligence, and it's a special intelligence mission for Venezuela and Cuba. And only three such missions were created, one for Iran, one for North Korea, and the third for Venezuela, Cuba. You can see that the group of countries that Venezuela is included in are nations that have already been designated enemy states by the United States and terror states. And this is the policy that's continued. That mission still exists to this date. And so what it means is that Venezuela, Cuba continue to be key targets and priorities for U.S. foreign policy relating to security and defense. And we've seen that increase. I mean, this year, 2010, Obama's Director of National Intelligence designated Venezuela and Hugo Chavez as the anti-U.S. leader in the region, which, you know, is a complete distortion of really what Chavez's policies are. It's not anti-U.S., it's anti-U.S. intervention in the region, but certainly not anti-U.S. And it's a way of justifying an increase in this type of aggressive policy, which I think is unfortunately what's going to happen. If we have people like Connie Mack running the subcommittee on foreign relations for Latin America, who declared in that conference in the Congress last month that, you know, with the new Republican majority, they need to take actions to directly confront Hugo Chavez head on. I mean, that's a direct threat against the life of President Chavez.
It's been such a constant interest since Michael and I were kids, you know, since Cuba, but of course way before there were all kinds of, you know, interventions and coups. But I remember going to Cuba in 73, June 73, and I was sitting down with, I guess, the law school dean, and, you know, everybody was pretty excited. You had Allende, still the president of Chile. You had a progressive government in Peru. You had the Tipimoros in Uruguay and lots of things going on in Latin America. And then 6 months later, completely changed situation. And of course, similarly in 80, 81, you had Cuba, Grenada, the Salvadorans on the verge of a victory there. And by 88, Nicaragua, of course, by 88, pretty well done for. Historically, how would you say that we're in a similar situation, or are there more constraints on the U.S. operating?
The U.S. sort of thought that at the end of the 20th century, they had pretty much taken care of any kind of leftist uprising or threat, as they perceive it, in Latin America, which is why attention was sort of reoriented towards other regions of the world. And while that was happening, you know, all these changes started to occur in Latin America. And yes, the aggression is increasing from certain sectors in the U.S. government towards these countries in Latin America that are involved in progressive changes and advancing and, you know, all kinds of social programs and regional consolidation integration. While that is increasing, what has happened is that more countries and governments have surfaced that no longer want that type of U.S. policy in the region. I mean, just on the first weekend of December, there was an Ibero-American summit in Argentina, which includes Spain, still, as its colonizing role in Latin America. But all the countries of the region were there, and they agreed on a protocol, a clause in a declaration, specifically rejecting these coup d'etats that have been resurfacing in the region, and including that actions would be taken, sanctions against any government that was overthrown by a coup in the region, things like that. And there was also a rejection of U.S. meddling in continuing to meddle in the region, and, you know, ongoing intervention or trying to increase it. And I think that was very important because it shows that governments that are still, you know, there are still several right-wing governments in Latin America. We've got Peru and Colombia and Chile, but they also agree and rejected those types of coup attempts. And, I mean, we see it happening. There have been several blocs that have been created. UNASUR is another one, the Union of South American Nations, all of South America coming together and creating a regional block of integration and trade and, you know, exchange without the U.S. hand in the middle of it all. And we have ALBA. I mean, so I think, yeah, I mean, there's been a consolidation here in the region, which is what is sort of more threatening to the U.S. now than ever before, is that they can't just come in and take countries out. I mean, how often did it happen during the 20th century that a coup failed in Latin America? Almost never.
It was nice to see these fail. I think we're getting to the end of the show, but a last question. If you followed the WikiLeaks document on Honduras, you're aware of that one?
Of course.
Why don't you describe in our last couple minutes what that document is and then, I guess, Hillary's response on the Honduras coup?
Well, the document is an internal memo sent from the U.S. ambassador in Honduras up to the Secretary of State, basically, you know, in the weeks after the coup, saying that the coup that took place in June 2009 against President Manuel Zelaya was completely illegal, had no constitutional foundation, despite the fact that those that executed the coup tried to justify it based on their constitution. And it went through a series of arguments, basically arguing on this, and in fact confirming that it was an illegal coup in the eyes of the U.S. embassy, which is completely the contrary position that the U.S. government assumed publicly during the events of the coup in Honduras in 2009. And so what it shows is an absolute hypocrisy on the part of the U.S. government. I mean, the State Department never declared the events formally as a coup d'etat while they were taking place and afterward, and even publicly to date, whereas privately, they clearly said it was an illegal coup d'etat and that, you know, there was no justification for it at all. And the U.S. government, using their new sort of policy of smart power, as they call it, negotiated and pressured and influenced countries in the region to eventually, and even influenced President Manuel Zelaya, who was overthrown, by trying to convince him that they were working on his side to get him back into office, when in fact that was never their objective. And to this date, I mean, democracy hasn't yet to be restored in Honduras. Nevertheless, you know, the U.S. government continues to push for the regional acceptance of this illegitimate government that has now taken power in Honduras. So, yeah, I mean, it's a revealing document in the sense that it just shows the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy, you know, but that's what we're seeing in most of the documents coming out from this WikiLeaks publication, and we're seeing in the case of Venezuela as well, and other countries in the region, that not necessarily that what they say publicly is not what they say privately, because in the case of Venezuela, it's the same thing, because it's a hostile position.
You've written an article on this recent, what you would call, right-wing Latin American coup meeting, what I would call. Well, how do people get that article? How do they get your writings? Because this is material that no one in the United States is really up on.
You're well informed. You're there in Caracas, Venezuela. We would like our listeners to be able to touch base with you. How do we reach out to you, Eva?
Yes, and I've written several books, actually, on the subject.
So tell us first about the article about this, and then your most recent book.
You can get all my articles in English on my blog, which is www.chavezcode.com. And the Chavez Code is the name of my first book, which is about the U.S. government role in the coup against Chavez. And you can find links on the blog to my other writings. But something that important I just want to throw in is the basis of my work has been using the U.S. Freedom of Information Act to try to declassify documents,
nice,
not obtain them illegally, but declassify them about U.S. intervention in Latin America. And one really important fact that has been demonstrated in evidence irrefutably through these documents is an increasing funding coming out using U.S. taxpayer dollars to fund organizations and political parties and groups in Latin America that are trying to destabilize democratically elected governments. And it's really important for the U.S. people to understand that that's one of the ways that millions and millions of their taxpayer dollars are being spent, which I think is something that the U.S. people need to know and should consider.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Eva Gallagher.
That's critical.
www.chavezcode.com to get Eva Gallagher's book, Chavez Code, and link to her other writings. Thank you very much, Eva, for talking to us from Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Want to hear Law & Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law & Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
Telling us still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the Fontainebleau, working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, then just follow.